And I'm not a really good American because I like to form my own opinions.
Huh? What?
There's tons of examples of corporate greed, inequality, and disregard for the environment that make people wonder if markets are evil. And they are.
Maybe Lise is right about America being the land of opportunity, and maybe Adil has a point about the machinery of capitalism being oiled with the blood of the workers.
Where it's like, hey, wake up, liberals. You can't always do, sometimes you gotta, but that's actual quote from Karl Marx.
In recognizing a communist, physical appearance counts for nothing. If he openly declares himself to be a communist, we take his word for it.
If I were to ever start a country with a communist government, wink, wink, wait 12 years.
Men are seduced by communists, women so much so that they deem communism nice. Communists murdered mostly the Nazis.
Bottom-up horizontal connection, sharing at all levels is key.
Describing is anarchy. Are you an anarchist?
You mean, am I a member?
An anarchist group, yes.
Anarchists have a group?
I believe so, sure.
What kind of garbage is that? Oops, my anarchy symbol.
This is Dan Platt with Three Left Show. I'm your host. So, what is this program? So, this program covers news issues, thought, and activism, anything of interest from a radical left perspective for the curious or the committed, promoting a post-capitalist present and future via direct democracy and a commons economy. This show is for going in a different direction as far as an educational program for those unacquainted with leftist ideas, and just generally want to talk about politics better, or just expand your horizons. Yes. So, an observation. This weekend, I'm going to go see the Joker movie, right? It's what everyone's talking about, because everyone likes talking about culture more than politics. And when we do talk about politics, it's usually like we're talking about culture. Example. People know who the president is in the same way they usually know they can name a few movies Tom Hanks has been in, right? They can name who the president is, like it's a pop culture factoid. But if asked or pressed on, say, what do they, or that there's a general ignorance of what the president does, has done in their time in office, what kind of people are they appointing? What kind of wars are they starting? What kind of policies are actually on the table? Even if you listen to NPR and other, you know, sort of moderate to liberal programming, you're still not getting all of the options that are available. This show exists. I'm doing this show because in most mainstream, any media channels, there is a lack of options of where can we go in talking, even talking about politics more than just a play-by-play sports team versus team, Democrats versus Republicans, or talking about politics in a... But it's been mentioned that to concentrate on culture as if it's politics, that culture is upstream from politics, that culture affects our politics, is to focus on the ideas and ignore what are called the material conditions, meaning, example, why don't we talk about how things are produced, how media is produced, instead of just the media itself? Usually ignored is, how is our media being produced? Oh, it's being produced by a corporate oligarchy that is completely driven by profit-making. Maybe that affects what kind of media is made. Even if it does have a anti-consumerist message from time to time, it's still a product being sold for a ticket price. Contrast that with the production of this show, which even though I'm using, you know, capitalist-made products here, the computer in front of me, the microphone, but the mode of production is a community-run, volunteer-run, nonprofit community studio, community radio, with a mission that can be both freewheeling like a college radio station, but not be restricted by capital and investors like a commercial station would be. This is the first step to thinking like a Marxist, which is the title of this episode. So that was just the intro. So here's another example. Got a lot of stories to talk about. Well, I'm trying to de-sniffle myself here, my nose. So, from the Business Insider, AOC, Congressman Cortez, she tweets about workers being paid less than the value they create, and that this is essentially a restatement of Marx's labor theory of value. Let's talk about what that is. Last month, U.S. Rep. Cortez tweeted a criticism of Ivanka Trump, who is against the idea of a guaranteed minimum wage. And this is just having a minimum wage. Because she said people want to work for what they get. So I think this idea of a guaranteed minimum is not something most people want. Completely detached. Kind of a let them eat cake moment. Cortez responded, a living wage isn't a gift, it's a right. Workers are often paid far less than the value they create. That caught my eye, says this author, because it is essentially a restatement of Karl Marx's labor theory of value. I find it interesting that someone who writes for Business Insider has read Marx. And it's not often you see that discussed in the mainstream media, though of course you don't have to read like the whole text to know what a certain idea is. And the idea of the labor theory of value is just that value in a marketplace comes from labor. Let's go further in with the example of a shoe factory? Before Marx, the value of any product was regarded as pretty much the same as its price in the marketplace. Maybe that's how we're taught to think about it. It's how much you pay to avoid making the product yourself, according to Adam Smith. The reason you might spend $100 on a pair of shoes is that even though $100 is a lot, it's a lot easier than making the shoes yourself. But Marx, who was also a big fan of Smith, was more interested in how products acquire value as they come into existence. He uses the example of leather shoes. Apologies to vegans. And my own vegan values make me feel icky. A cow doesn't slaughter itself and magically transform into a pair of leather shoes. This happens only because workers apply labor to the corpse of the cow, turning its skin into leather, and then sewing that leather into shoes. Only after labor has been applied do shoes have any value. It's the labor that creates the value, not just the fact that the shoes can be traded for money. So, certain truisms like money isn't everything, and the root of all evil is money. These kind of things don't have a lot of explanatory power. They don't really make up a good worldview. But they do eke that it is the work that one does that is valuable, not the money itself. The money is just a symbol. Just as media and culture are also just made up of symbols. So they shouldn't really be put as being more important than how things are actually produced. And how are things produced? Well, let's go into it. Let's say a shoe factory has one worker who makes each day 5 pairs of shoes. They sell for $100 each. The factory makes $500 a day in sales, 5 times as much. The worker's wage is about $10 an hour for a 10-hour day. So the worker is paid $100 a day. The worker can afford to buy only one pair of shoes even though they have made 5. At first, this doesn't feel like a problem because obviously there are billions of people who need shoes. Assuming that, you know, you have to distribute the shoes. The factory could sell those other pair, 4 pairs, to someone somewhere. What concerned Marx was that ultimately, every single worker on the planet and every office and factory is paid less than the value of the goods they create. It is not possible for all these goods to be produced to be bought by all of the workers that make them. Thus, you get recessions. Additionally, there is also always a reserve army of unemployed people who can't afford to buy anything, which exacerbates the problem, makes it worse. And thus, there's a tendency for this system, where labor value is extracted, to collapse. The tendency is for the system to collapse and for recessions to destroy shoe factories whose customers are too poor or not numerous enough to buy all the shoes made. Marx believed this collapse can be staved off, he argued, if the shoe factory goes to great lengths, for instance, investing in new technology, which is the usual talking point by our mainstream class, allowing the shoe worker to double their productivity and make 10 pairs, or maybe the same number of shoes at a low price. But the collapse is only pushed into the future. New technology will also be acquired by everyone else, squeezing those profits away, and squeezing some factories out of business. If the factory buys shoemaking machines instead of hiring new workers, still faces the problem of producing more shoes that can be bought by the workers making them. So I'll start there and summarize the point that capitalism inherently, because of this dynamic between those who make the stuff and the owners of, you know, the holders of capital, that, say, invested in the factory itself. It allows the workers to make the shoes, right? But the value, you know, the factory itself doesn't make the value. The workers in the factory makes the value. So that's, at the very least, an argument that workers need to be paid adequate wages. Maybe half of what the value they make instead of a fifth of it. Those are the advantages of unionization. Workers can act as a group in their interests instead of individual by individual. Since the owner is usually an individual, though with a corporation, it's also a group of individuals. And a group of individuals can be thought of as a class. This is thinking like a Marxist, to think in terms of classes and groups instead of individual by individual. Because we usually moralize and think in moral terms on an individual by individual basis. But what if we think about morality and economics group in groups? So how can we apply this? So I've got two stories that will fill most of the rest of the hour. I'm already a third in. Ooh. Both are about poverty in different contexts, but they're both Midwest contexts, and they both involve housing. Because, hey, it's not just about the production of things, right? What about the things that weren't produced by humans at all? Like land, right? We assign that a market value, but no labor has actually been involved in it except the transformation of land, say, with buildings or infrastructure. But a lot of infrastructure was produced by the public, right? It couldn't have been produced by a private holder. It has been tried. It was always ineffective. Because private roads would only serve a private need. Economics. So this is from Bloomberg Opinion. Important to point out this is opinion, all right? It would have a very different way. You know, they even have, just like this show has, a disclaimer, this opinion does not represent our reporting side. This is an opinion piece. This is by Mark Whitehouse, published in June. It is called Black Poverty is Rooted in Real Estate Exploitation. A new study in Chicago shows how the dream of home ownership was converted into a poverty trap. Now, racists, white supremacists, what have you, Republicans, bandy about talking points that ignore class. They ignore historical conditions. It's ahistorical is usually what that's called when you ignore the actual effects of history, actions in the past. You know, anyone who says, it was in the past. We need to move on. That's to ignore. That's basically say, like, that's to assume that the problems of the past have been resolved. But it's actually a complete dismissal of those problems. For example, this story. One question is, or should be, central to any assessment of the state of America. Why, more than a century and a half after slavery ended, does the typical black family remain so much poorer than the typical white family? Now, if you go by a non-Marxist, i.e. neoliberal version of, you know, ideology, a worldview, you'd say it's their culture. This is something racists say. It's their culture. Blacks have a bad culture, you know, rap music, saggy pants, etc. They need the right culture, and that will lead to the right economics. But it's really quite the other way around. Let's dig in. A new study on housing in Chicago illustrates a big part of the answer. Generation after generation, the U.S. system of real estate finance has enriched whites at the expense of blacks. This is structural racism in action. Housing has long played a crucial role in American wealth accumulation. People buy homes with fairly subsidized mortgages. They build up equity and pass the assets on to their children. But as recently as the 1960s, government policy excluded blacks entirely in a practice known as redlining, if you haven't already known about that. The Federal Housing Administration designated predominantly black neighborhoods as a no-go zone for government-insured mortgage loans. So the FHA also wouldn't guarantee any loans for mixed-race developments, which then creates ghettos. The presence of even single black family was enough to warrant rejection. So it's important to point out this is both a government policy and, because it involves loans and banks, it is a economic policy. Idea one to disentangle is that the political, i.e. government, and the economy, what owners and banks are doing, are separate. They're not separate. Hence, blacks had to find other ways to obtain shelter. One was contract for deed, an arrangement usually offered by speculators who bought properties expressly for the purpose. It required a down payment and regular monthly installments from the occupant. So when we go into that second idea, the second idea in Tangle is that racism and profit seeking are separate. They serve each other. So even if you take racism out of the equation, say racism has been solved, no one has any implicit or explicit bias towards a black man or woman, or gender, or non-conforming. That doesn't take away, that doesn't remove profit-seeking behavior to exploit those who are exploitable. And if banks aren't giving mortgages to a class of people, right, for bigoted reasons, explicitly bigoted reasons, then there will be economic reasons to exclude that class of people. Let's see. Just as slavery was produced with a tenant farming system, this is similar, but pertaining to housing. So it required a down payment and regular monthly installments from the occupant. But that's where the similarities to a mortgage ended. The sale price and effective interest rate tended to be wildly inflated. The buyer assumed all the responsibilities of a homeowner, including repairs and taxes, while the seller retained title, along with the power to evict, for missing even a single payment. As a result, families who bought, quote-unquote, on contract didn't accumulate equity and faced a long and precarious path to ownership. Chicago became a hotbed of contract for deed transactions in the mid-20th century as large numbers of blacks, still brutally persecuted in the South, moved to northern industrial cities in what is historically called the Great Migration. The city also saw one of the country's largest organized rebellions against the practice, the Contract Buyers League, which filed two federal lawsuits, using the courts, seeking relief from the contract's onerous provisions. The lawsuits failed, usually, but for historians, their long list of homes and tenants, which were cited as evidence, provide a rare and valuable window into what was otherwise a largely undocumented and unregulated phenomenon. So it's through the records of this lawsuit that these researchers actually had evidence to tangle with. Now researchers, including a Jack McNamara, who is a young Jesuit seminarian who helped organize the league, have tapped those lawsuits, along with municipal records and the work of other scholars, to come up with an estimate of how much this one out of several other practices in one city has set back black families. Using data on sales and mortgage rates, they calculated how much each family's payments exceeded what they would have been if the property had been purchased at a prevailing market rate, a market price, with a conventional mortgage loan. Wait, they then added it up for all the contract properties they could identify from the years 1950 to 1970. The results. Black families were overcharged somewhere between $3 and $4 billion. The real estate agents and investors who profited were almost exclusively white, so this represents a direct transfer of wealth from one race to another. Worse, the contract's exorbitant terms, along with the lack of equity to borrow against, left black families without the means to invest in anything else, contributing to the physical decline of their neighborhoods. By investing in their properties or other properties, meaning painting them regularly, maybe doing an abatement to remove lead, all that kind of stuff. The predation did not end in the 60s, of course. It evolved. There was the FHA scandal in the 70s in which indiscriminate federal lending and outright corruption enabled speculators to sell inner-city homes to blacks at inflated prices, resulting in widespread foreclosures. There was the subprime boom of the 2000s, more recently, in which blacks were steered into inappropriately expensive loans that enriched a whole ecosystem of mortgage industry professionals that will come again later in the show, but often left borrowers with nothing but an eviction notice and a bad credit history. In the wake of the subprime bust, investors, included private equity firms, have again targeted the same neighborhoods, buying up houses on the cheap and renting them back to black and minority tenants, sometimes under contracts very similar to those of the 60s. So you can say, racism solved. We had a black president. But capitalism remains. Capitalism holds people back. That's thinking in terms of class. There's a capitalist class, and there's a non-capitalist class. Thus, there's usually that impotence, well, blacks just need to be capitalists. Well, what does it look like when then a black woman then becomes one of those capitalists? Next story, from The Guardian, titled Evicted by Matthew Desmond. He reviews, what if the problem of poverty is that it's profitable to other people? Now, this is one of those, like, aha, epiphany moments on my road to being a radical leftist, I suppose, is to just think about how it is profitable for people to be dumb, ignorant, and poor. How much better it is for the scammers out there. But they don't have to be bullies. They can just be an owner and do exactly what an owner should do in their interests. All kinds of classically immoral things, but as far as the market's concerned, they are being a good capitalist. Such as those pharmaceutical executives that price gouge with insulin. Or oil executives that buy up our government, that pollute and kill our planet. It's not that these men are personally evil. It's that they're actually being very good capitalists. Thus, it is capitalism, if we are going to call something evil and moral. It's particularly amoral, I suppose, but as far as its consequences to life, welfare, and just general well-being, it's good for a few people, but then we can also go into how it actually harms the upper-class people, too. But back to the story known as Evicted. Oh, that's right. Evicted is the name of a book, and this is a review of that book. There's an enormous amount of pain and poverty in this rich land, argues American sociologist Desmond in this brilliant book about housing and the lives of 8 families in Milwaukee. What if the dominant discourse on poverty is just wrong? What if the problem isn't that poor people have bad morals, you know, the individualist thing, that they're lazy and impulsive and irresponsible and have no family values, but that they lack the skills and the smarts that fit into our shiny 21st century economy? What if the problem is that poverty is itself profitable? These are the questions at the heart of Evicted, Matthew Desmond's extraordinary ethnographic study of tenants in low-income housing in a deindustrialized middle-sized city of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. You might not think that there is a lot of money to be extracted from a dilapidated trailer park or a black neighborhood of sagging duplexes, fading murals, 24-hour daycares, but you would be wrong. Toby Charney makes $400,000 a year out of his 131 trailers, some of which are little better than hovels. Shanera Tarver, a former school teacher who is one of the only black female landlords in the city, makes enough in rent on her numerous properties, some presentable, others squalid, to holiday in Jamaica and attend conferences on real estate. Yes, black capitalism is what we need. No. And other black leaders of the past have said. Desmond follows the intertwined fortunes of 8 families and a host of minor characters. Arlene Bell and Doreen Hinkleson are black mothers clinging to the edge of a low-wage employment. Now, I want to say that so far I've been putting this into race intersectional lines here. But obviously, if you're light-skinned, of course you're being exploited too. You shouldn't just be a capitalist so the boot isn't on you. We should take off the boots. We should destroy these mechanisms of oppression, which are known as what we can call modes of production. You know, the modes of creating value. Or if we focus on labor as where value is created instead of numbers in a bank account, then we can have that more community, egalitarian, moral society, and spiritually fulfilling. On with the story. It is sometimes a little hard to keep up with the storylines as they weave in and out of the text, but no matter. What is important is that Desmond takes people who are usually seen as worthless. There is even a trailer dweller nicknamed Heroine Susie, and shows us their full humanity, how hard they struggle to retain their dignity, humor, and kindness in conditions that continually drag them down. The main condition holding them back, Desmond argues, is rent. The standard measure is that your rent should be no more than 30% of your income. But for poor people, it could be 70% or more. After he paid Chiara his $550 rent out of his welfare check, Lamar had only $2.19 a day for the month. When he is forced to repay a welfare check, he had been sent an error and falls behind on rent. He sells his food stamps for half their face value and volunteers to paint an upstairs apartment, but it is not enough. People such as Lamar live in chronic debt to their landlord, who can therefore oust them easily whenever it is convenient. Say nothing of, say, sexual impropriety, say the genders are different. If they demand repairs, for example, like Doreen, or if a better tenant comes along. Chiara liked renting to the clients of a for-profit agency that handles, for a fee, the finances of people on disability payments who can't manage on their own. Money from government programs intended to help the poor, you know, welfare, disability benefits, the earned income tax credit, go straight into landlords' pockets. And ironically, right, and the cost of rising fuel. Public housing and housing vouchers are scarce. 3 in 4 who qualify for housing assistance get nothing. Now, I want to point out, this is the main leftist critique of the policy known as guaranteed income, meaning universal guaranteed income, where everyone is given, say, as presidential candidate Yang proposes, $1,000 a month. This is to replace all pre-existing welfare, because he lines it up as a choice. Current welfare benefits are $1,000. Either way, landlords and other capitalists are going to scoop up that money. It's on the table. It's not fixed to actually providing people's needs. So this is where the counterproposal is, instead of guaranteed income, but to ensure guaranteed housing, guaranteed food access, guaranteed health care. That would be the better policy, because it decouples these things. Oh, and education as well. But it decouples these things from being commodities, from things to extract value from. Continue on with the story. Even in the Great Depression, evictions used to be rare. Now, each year, hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions, of renters are put out on the street. Even a paid-up tenant can be easily evicted. Arlene loses one apartment when her son Jory throws a snowball at a passing car, and the enraged driver kicks in the front door, and another when the police come after Jory when he kicks a teacher and runs home. Any kind of trouble that brings the police can lead to eviction, which means women can lose their homes if they call 911 when a man beats them up, period. Think about that the next time someone asks why women don't call the cops on violent partners. As Desmond shows, the main victims of eviction are women. Why? They are paid less than men for doing the same job, for one. They are less able to make deals with their landlord, who is almost always a man, to work off part of their rent with manual labor. The main reason, though, is that women are raising children as single mothers. They not only have all the costs and burdens of child rearing, they need bigger apartments, which, since landlords dislike renting to families with young children, are harder to find and a lot harder to keep. Other sociologists, one named Catherine Eden, for example, have found that single mothers often get help under the table from their children's fathers. But Arlene, Doreen, and Doreen's adult daughter, Patrice, get mostly trouble from men who are variously abusive, addicted, banished, or in prison. In one of the book's many sad, small moments, Arlene claims she receives child support in order to seem more stable and respectable to a prospective landlord. The reality is that she gets nothing. Desmond lays out the crucial role housing plays in creating and reinforcing white privilege. In Milwaukee, one of the most segregated cities in the U.S. All black people suffer from housing discrimination, and all white people benefit at least a little bit from this dividend. A landlord who will rent to them, but not to black people, for instance, or offer them a nicer apartment. Black people have the worst housing in the worst neighborhoods. The great fear of the trailer park people, who are all white, is that they will end up on the black side of town. Eviction hits black women hardest of all, and the bleak benches of housing courts, which deal with disputes between landlords and tenants, are full of black women and their children. Quote, if incarceration had come to define the lives of men from impoverished black neighborhoods, eviction was shaping the lives of women. Poor black men were locked up. Poor black women were locked out. What are the social costs of eviction? It puts incredible stress on any family. It prevents people from saving the comparatively small sums that they would let them stabilize their situation. They are always starting over from scratch, losing their possessions in the chaos of removal. And as the son of someone who owns a property, when someone's evicted and they leave a lot of stuff behind, either because they have to or because they didn't care to, you know, because a lot of it's trash, but some of it is rather good. And we call it the tenant store, because some of it is salvageable. Putting things in storage and losing them when you can't pay the fees, even when you can get it out of the apartment. An eviction on your record makes the next apartment harder to get. Eviction damages children who are always changing schools, giving up friends and toys and pets, and living with the exhaustion and depression of their parents. This is something I watched as a kid all the time in the magnet schools I went to. We watched Jory go from a sweet, protective older brother to an angry, sullen boy subject to violent outbursts who is falling way behind in school. So really, if we want to solve the, you know, angry male problem in schools, maybe we need to solve the housing problem. And the housing problem is that it's a commodity, that it's something to make money off of. And this is not to destroy the concept of personal home ownership, but that home ownership needs to go under the rubric of that great question of who's paying for it. Is it a bank? Or could it be a public trust? Could it be the state? Something that keeps housing prices level is massive amounts of public housing, like more than half needs to be public housing. That stabilizes the value of housing. You know, like, oh yeah, we need housing, housing demand is up. We need to build more housing. Right? But markets, capitalist markets, they build housing for those who can pay. Those who can get mortgage loans. And those aren't the people who are in greatest need. People in need are the people in here. Okay, last paragraph. Eviction makes it hard to keep up with the many appointments required by courts and the complicated welfare system, you know, which depends on sending you notices to your address. If your address keeps changing and you miss that letter, then you're not going to get the payment, the help that is actually, you know, in great best intentions, sent. And it also makes it harder for the social workers to actually keep track of the people they're supposed to be helping. So several characters have their benefits cut because notices were sent to the wrong address. Eviction destroys communities. When people move frequently, they don't form the social bonds and pride in place that encourage them to care for their block and look out for their neighbors. With Doreen's eviction, 32nd Street lost a steadying presence, someone who loved and invested in the neighborhood, who contributed to making the block safer, but Wright Street didn't gain one. There is an enormous amount of pain and poverty in this rich land, Desmond writes in his conclusion. That is easy to say, and many books by journalists and academics have done so. By examining one city through the microscopic lens of housing, however, he shows us how the system that produces that pain and poverty was created and is maintained. I can't remember when an ethnographic study so deepened my understanding of American life. So this article was, this review was written by Kappa Poland from The Guardian. Moving on. Last thing. Now, from housing to infrastructure and transportation. So this is more of a New York City-based story. I live there, so it certainly relates to me. But I think it could definitely be related to everything else because we're talking about classes. And now we're going to talk about a kind of the divide-and-conquer strategy when it comes to class, or elaborate once I'm done with it. Now, a piece from The Intercept, Voices column, which I guess is the same as Opinion, but not quite. But it is coming from the perspective of a Peter Mass, with two A's, written last month. It's titled, Why is Bill de Blasio Trying to Kill Me? New York's mayor claims to be progressive, but favors drivers over bicyclists. Just to start with that title, talking about groups of people instead of individuals making their private transportation choices. We make choices in an environment. We live in a society, folks, is what I'm saying. We live in a society. Meaning, you live in a shitty, you live in a bad society, you turn out bad. Everyone turns out bad in the end. Thus, cynical mindsets of how everyone's evil and everyone has this natural prediction of violence just under the surface. Well, maybe if we had a society that didn't go to war and wasn't an empire and didn't base all of its social contracts on an enforcement with violence. But here's another form of structural violence that encourages immorality and aggressiveness and bad will towards each other by putting two groups against each other. For a number of years, when I was covering wars in places like Bosnia, Iraq, and Afghanistan, I would wake up in the morning and conduct a risk assessment of what I planned to do during the day. I carefully considered the dangers ahead. Ambushes, landmines, bombings, kidnapping, and how to avoid and mitigate them. I ran endless scenarios through my mind, and when I headed out into the insanity of the day, I was extremely vigilant to signs of trouble. I never expected that the risk assessment skills I developed in war zones would be relevant to my life as a Brooklyn dad with a desk job in Manhattan. But that was before I started biking to work. It's not that hazards of biking in New York City are reminiscent of the front lines around Sarajevo, that's in former Yugoslavia, Bosnia, but let me say this. I was kind of crazy to do the things I did back in my war reporter days, and I am kind of crazy to ride a bike in New York City. This time, the leader I blame for the mayhem around me is not a warlord or war criminal. He is Bill de Blasio, the supposedly progressive mayor of New York, who says all the right things about the need to respond to the world's climate emergency, yet refuses to do the one thing in his own city that would save the lives of his constituents and the planet we live on. Talking about transitioning from car-based cities to mass transit and bicycling-based cities, he implies. As you might have heard, there has been a spike in cyclists killed in New York City. The count is now up to 22 this year. More than double the amount for all of last year, and the latest victim killed by a truck just a day ago was a 14-year-old boy. There has also been more pedestrians killed by cars this year, including a 10-year-old boy who was waiting for a bus earlier this month when the driver of an SUV plowed over the sidewalk and killed him, and a 1-year-old girl in a stroller who was killed just days ago by yet another SUV driver who jumped a curb. Follow-up opinions from ideological enemies, I'll call them, would say that it is these pedestrians' fault. They weren't paying enough attention to these monstrous vehicles jumping curves and being where they shouldn't be. Or that there's a shared responsibility between the person driving a 2-ton machine and the person who is not. Because one has the ability to kill the other, but not the other way around. I would not call that shared responsibility. Responsibility falls not on individual drivers, mind you, but on the classes of people, the classes of drivers, the classes of people who encourage, even now, even with climate catastrophe facing us, ignoring the possibility, the necessity actually, of moving away from car-based cities. If anything depresses me, it's moving around my city and going through this, the strip area, you know, that's completely car based. It has all car dealerships and they're still there. The fact that they're still there. It's almost 2020, supposed to be midway in our transition, so-called transition to a, green, accountable economy. And there's still these, all these car dealerships. There's still this expectation that we have a car-based city. It will always be this way. Now in the future, oh, there'll be electric cars or there'll be biofuel burning cars. You know, there's all these little like business ideas. Like, we don't have a biofuel seller in Albany that I'm aware of, for cars, maybe doing conversions to convert cars to burn biofuel. But then I think better of that idea. It's like, well, no, that's, cause that's continuing cars and driving and the need for this infrastructure that will kill in America 30,000 people a year. And in New York, it's around 30. Imagine if that was terrorism. Now in that, there's a very specific person to blame, right? But no, now there's the whole system can be blamed, the society, right? And in order to change society, we need to stop looking at the culture of driving, the culture of cycling, you know, and make fun of people, whatever. But the mode of production, how is our, all these roads produced? How is our transportation system produced? We gotta think about that. We gotta look at that. Last year, nearly 11,000 pedestrians were injured. So this is the injury rate. Were injured by cars in the city, according, and so how's that for healthcare costs? According to the DOT. And the number of bikers hurt was close to 5,000. That's not even a full accounting because it's based on reports by the NYPD. Lots of biker and pedestrian injuries go unreported. Because why bother? A few years ago, after I had to jump out of the way of a bus that still grazed me as it illegally turned into a crosswalk, a police officer on the scene asked me to not file a report. I assume because he didn't want to hassle paperwork, I filed it anyway. If you regularly ride a bike, you know all too well the bloody story that soulless mortality spreadsheets don't convey. During any ride, there will likely be a couple of occasions. If you did not quickly brake for that car that illegally crossed into your path at an intersection, or did not shout at the oblivious pedestrian walking into your bike lane, or pull aside to avoid a biker going the wrong way, or swerve to avoid a suddenly opening car door, or notice a 5-inch pothole just ahead, you would end up as another digit in the statistical category that the city describes as KSI, which stands for killed or seriously injured. I never expected that a phrase I often whisper to myself at the end of a busy day in a war zone is one I continue to whisper at the end of a two-wheel journey home. I've got it easy because I don't ride a bike for a living all day long as legions of low-wage workers must do in the messenger and food delivery trades. There's a particularly demented nightmare that haunts the cyclists of New York City, or at least me, getting doored. That's what happens when you're biking on one of de Blasio's unprotected lanes and someone in a stationary car, just inches to your side, opens their door without bothering to check whether a cyclist is coming. You are riding along and following the rules and trusting de Blasio's encouragements to ride a bike in the great metropolis of New York, when suddenly, like a flipper in a pinball machine, but this isn't a pinball machine, it's a street and it's your life, a door opens and smacks into you. The injuries you suffer at that moment can be quite severe, but the worst may be just ahead. When cyclists are doored by parked cars, they tend to fall into the street, where they can get run over by a moving vehicle. In New York, 8 cyclists have been doored to death since 2014. Now, I want to point out the perspective of this author is de Blasio's bike lanes in New York City. But in any city, like my own, we have no protected bike lanes. All bike lanes that are put in are of the unprotected variety. And I want to mention that protected bike lane in Albany, my city, was on the table. It was encouraged by our bicycling coalition, but in the road diet study and in the design phase, it was basically there needed to be a compromise position to have bike lanes, but they're unprotected. The reason given, at least in my snowy city, is that it would be impossible to plow. It would be harder to plow both the bike lane and the cars. Because once there's enough snow accumulation, the snowbanks get very large. It basically takes like 5 feet out of the street. It makes things very tight in the winter. We could make cars smaller, but that's not what GM's doing. There's a point of commonality between the chaos of New York biking and the mayhem of far-flung war zones. Chaos is not a condition that just happens like an act of God or magic. It must be created. Societies are not always or naturally at war. Most are at peace most of the time, if not all the time. When war happens, it is largely the product of decisions and actions by powerful leaders to create the destabilization required for hostilities to break out. That is what is happening in the streets of New York under the neglectful and hypocritical rule of Mayor de Blasio. But to be more accurate, he means the rule of neoliberalism, because de Blasio is simply just another neoliberal mayor. Because it is not an individual problem here, as he will kind of go on. It is the problem of the status quo, which is, you know, class-based. Let's finish this up. When de Blasio was elected mayor in 2013, he inherited a city that was quickly moving to a future much more free of cars than its past. Thanks to the surprisingly forward-looking policies of billionaire, and last I checked, the 11th millionth richest man in the world, Michael Bloomberg, who was terrible in most ways, but was great on the issue of cars, pedestrians, and bikes. Bloomberg, who famously took the subway a fair amount, infuriated drivers and businesses by speeding up the installation of bike lanes and, among other things, turning Times Square into a pedestrian-friendly zone, a move that has ended up being immensely successful, despite all the protests and nagging of drivers and the business owners who thought they would lose all their business, when, of course, business has been better. Bike lanes have expanded in de Blasio's time, but at a shameful pace and in a frankly dangerous way. Most of the lanes are not protected. Instead of a firm barrier that moving cars are unable to cross, all that separates bike riders from their deaths is a painted line or plastic stick every 20 or 30 yards. This has been referred to as paint and pray by policy, painting bike lanes and praying nobody will get hurt. It might be sufficient if several other things existed that do not. They include the following. Drivers respecting the lines and not driving in bike lanes. Delivery trucks and other vehicles not parking in bike lanes. Drivers are not opening their doors in front of bikers. Police enforcing these rules. Now here's where the author, and why I actually read this. He doesn't just put this up to cultural problems and that delivery truck drivers just need to be nicer and not park in lanes. He goes on. These things do not prevail, which is the main reason bikers and pedestrians are being killed and injured by the tens of thousands every year. On my daily commute, it's not unusual to encounter several delivery trucks, Ubers, or other vehicles parked in unprotected bike lanes on a single block, requiring me to merge into moving car traffic. Often the vehicles, rather than being stationary in a lane, are moving into it. Not long ago, I was riding in an unprotected lane in Union Square, and a truck cut into it, forcing me to the curb to save my life. "This is a bike lane," I shouted at the driver, to which he yelled back, "I don't effing care." Classic New York. As an excellent article by Aaron Gordon in Chapnick noted about unprotected lanes, instead of directing cyclists to a few carefully designed, safe, protected routes, it spreads them along dozens of lazy, dangerous, and haphazard bike lanes, inviting conflict. Honestly, it feels like the de Blasio administration is luring us into a trap. "Here's a new bike lane. Please come and use it. You're going to love it. Ha 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 ha." And don't take my word for it. Earlier this month, when someone on Twitter noted how dangerous it is to bike in New York City, the official account of Google Maps tweeted back, "Biking through New York isn't for the faint of heart, my dude." That tweet was later deleted, and I suppose a social media intern at Google was sent packing for telling the truth. At this point, you might be thinking, "Hold on, cyclists are a menace too. They scare and injure pedestrians all the time." My response is that I totally agree. The moment I get off a bike, I have to keep an eye out for cyclists, the ones who ride on the sidewalks, the ones who ride the wrong way on the street, the ones who speed through crosswalks. Bikers can be a-holes. The nearest I came to an accident in recent months was when a guy on an electric bike came roaring at me going the wrong way in a protected lane. I swerved to avoid a crash and shouted at him, prompting him to turn around and threaten to punch me out. The guy was maybe 20 years old and totally high, but I found a way to shame him from actual violence. "I'm 59 years old," I announced. "You want to take me on? Really? Really?" But let's remember a key thing. As cyclists are not the main problem. Last year, car drivers killed 115 people, pedestrians, in New York City, while bicycle riders killed zero. Please don't fall for this anti-bike propaganda of publications like the terrible New York Post, which loves to portray bikers as antifa horsemen of death. It's an own the libs distraction. But it's really just a matter of a bunch. Everyone is forced to punch down. Drivers are forced to, or rather put in the position of harming cyclists. Cyclists are put in the position of harming pedestrians. Pedestrians are put in the position of, I guess, of harming stray cats or whoever's below. There's always something below. The environment itself, I suppose, is always the ultimate victim. So let's stand back and look at what's going on. The problem is the absence of an infrastructure that gives bikers, pedestrians, and even delivery trucks what they need so they don't go to war against each other for the rat-infested crumbs of asphalt the city has them fighting over. Cyclists need protected lanes and prioritized lights. Give that to them, and they won't swarm the sidewalks. They won't drive the wrong way all the time, and they won't go through the intersections when they shouldn't. Give pedestrians the wide and safe sidewalks they need, and benches their weary legs desire, the trees that make shade in the summer and calm streets in which the majority of space is devoted to the majority of people who are not in private cars. This has been proven to work. It's not a risky leap. It has been ridiculously successful in cities across the world, particularly in Europe. This isn't happening, but instead we're pitted against each other. Honestly, I don't hate the truck drivers parking in bike lanes. They are victims too. They can't afford to not park there. The city, meaning de Blasio, but the city itself, has given them no choice because so much curb space is taken up by parked cars. And their bosses at UPS, FedEx, and Amazon haven't given them a choice either. How can low-wage drivers possibly meet an unrealistic quota of deliveries unless they break the law and park in bike lanes? It's time to wake up and realize this is the new sort, of class warfare on the streets of our cities. Let's unite against our political and corporate bosses and not squabble among ourselves. Let's also remember that this should not be turned into a law enforcement problem addressed primarily by giving the cops yet more power over our lives. This is a design problem. The streets are chaotic and dangerous because they are badly configured, and there are not too many cars, not because the NYPD isn't handing out enough tickets. The protected bike lanes are built and more streets are designed so that private cars cannot travel on them or are discouraged from doing so. There will be no need to pray that the NYPD will do the right thing. After all, they have shown little interest in doing much with the powers they have. Just go on Twitter and perform a search using the phrase police parked in bike lane. But am I overreacting? Well, look at who's doing the biking. About 75% of the riders of City Bike, that's the bike sharing service, the bike sharing program in New York, are male. A lot of women do not feel comfortable riding bikes in the city, and that's fundamentally unfair. And look at the ages of the males who ride. Most are relatively young. I rarely see bikers who are old enough, as I am, to shame 20-somethings into not punching them. It's Logan's Run out there, and it's a vast discrimination against anyone who is not a man in the physical prime of his life. This is a tragedy because New York City is ideal for short hops on bikes by people of all genders and ages, including children. It's a flat and high-density city. Yet since 2014, the number of bike riders has fundamentally stalled. Nobody new is showing up to this party because the word is out that it's not a party, it's a death race. And the final word, if I may, for Mayor de Blasio and his central role in not doing the one big thing that is within his power to save the planet. You will not find a mayor who is more devoted to talking about the urgent need to fight global warming. He has publicly celebrated the courage of Greta Thunberg, who sailed to New York in a sailboat earlier this month. And he has piously warned that humanity has only 10 years left to save the planet. He recognizes the crisis. But he has made some helpful changes, like announcing new guidelines on pollution levels for buildings. But these are the easy things. Getting cars and their lethal exhaust off the streets is the most important thing because of a vocal minority of drivers with outsized clout. But it's made the most difficult for that. They are like the NRA, except their weapons weigh 4,000 pounds and are turning the planet into cinders. The slightly good news is that de Blasio has finally ended his much-derided run for the Democratic presidential nomination. So we can hope he wakes up. It is unfathomable that during a climate emergency in which a key task is to reduce our use of cars, the allegedly progressive leader of America's largest city has done so little to turn bike riding into activity that's not life-threatening. So So to summarize my point, this is not de Blasio's problem for sure. That de Blasio is just another Democrat who talks one way, but governs as a neoliberal, which is to put first market economics, to put first market solutions, even though when it comes to infrastructure, you know, the streets, it's all public, right? This is a public problem. It's a public issue. It can't be privatized away. And it can't just be a matter of a little regulation. It has to be designed better. But it can't just be the infrastructure itself, right? As mentioned, some of the problems, like with the delivery drivers, is because of the mode of production of those businesses. The pressure to deliver more and more and more as fast as possible. And it's all going on those delivery drivers, the workers. They're victims too. They're under immense strain. And some of them are starting to unionize as well because they need protection and they need help. They can help themselves, but they need our solidarity. We all need each other's solidarity. And that means not when we encounter the inconveniences of our life, whether it be in the pharmacy, you know, in line, and someone's taking too long at the counter because they need to sort through their, you know, insurance. You know, these are not things to blame on the person in front of you holding you up. It is the system. It is the lack of single-payer healthcare. It is the lack of protected bike lanes. Now, of course, I read a story about a town that did put in protected bike lanes. But maybe, again, another design decision poorly made is that there's a curb that protects the bike lane between the car lanes and the bike lanes. And the curb is the same color. It's also black, like the road. And the story is that there's like 50 people this year that have busted their tires on this curb, saying this protected bike lane is harming the drivers. They're busting their tires because they keep jumping this curb or they keep going into it. Now, maybe the street itself is too narrow or something, or, you know, likely the cars are also too big. But can we pass a regulation that actually makes cars smaller so then we actually have more public space in our cities? No, it's always just about the emissions, as if that's the only harmful consequence. The size of the cars matter, too. That's what's, and I covered that, it's what's killing more pedestrians. Okay. I think I'm going to take a short break. I just wanted to finish that quickly. I'm going to play some music for you and... In the car, get the north, get the stand on the road. Don't care about the money, they don't like it. Propaganda! Just a bit, man! Propaganda! Just a bit, man! Propaganda! Just a bit, man! Propaganda! Just a hit! Rieka, the seda, tarjaka, makavaka, seda, repakavaka, tvrkinava, na hadiro, jode, in the law, in the kudava, the silo, the govri, in ma, in the kila, just a bit, man! In the kila, just a bit, man! In the kila, yeah, just a bit, man! Propaganda della setra che aveva nel mondo, che cava nella città da regina maravò, e che cava nella sera da carcina mahai, e che da quando era malarino, se ne la lava, che da piano da mattina da cava cresce, e che cava da morica di mani bello, e che ci si sale tu, a ricca, a no, a da chi ha voluto scelte, a ricca di comara. Propaganda! 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 Te la faccio in amore che anda
the scene for the cover of your body in the shittle of a dark digitoria motor, and then the theater for more you begin to shell over them and again. In the good in the theater, the rich on the mall, and the cover to the more in the city look over a year day, and the top, the economy of the good in the city of Chicago, the other linen, propaganda, the kid of Maria to the sewer, propaganda, the lover, hitting a lava shop, propaganda, the lodi, the Nicobatisha, propaganda, the lightning, not to show here.
Okay, and I'm back. So I have two stories, which will probably take the rest of the show. But I really like what these stories are going to talk about. Now, let's see. What should I go for first? I'm going to go for this one first, which is from Truthout, and another op-ed, because it seems like actual direct reporting. So this is called Beyond the Nonprofit Industrial Complex. So if you don't know this title, this article will go into that. But to put in the context of thinking like a Marxist and classes and non-individual solutions, nonprofits, as they're set up, are usually to address these negative consequences of our system, what markets can't handle. And I used to think, as a leftist, frame socialism as, when thinking about, you know, my journey towards being a socialist, I would think, like, what if every business was just a nonprofit? You know, profit's the problem. What if everything was a nonprofit? Well, that's not really quite realistic because, structurally thinking, nonprofits exist because profit making is so harmful that it needs these types of institutions to clean up the mess, you know, to take care of the army of unemployed, the effects of poverty, which is profitable. So if we let poverty just kind of continue, or poverty exists, you know, if we take it for granted that poverty, you know, as a fact, that poverty exists because it is profitable, then nonprofits exist just as a safety valve to assuage our moral sensibilities that capitalism maybe can continue, that it is a necessary evil so long as we have government regulations and programs and nonprofits to clean up, to take care of the excesses to an extent. It's horribly, the gaps are horrible. So let's go on. This is op-ed under Economy and Labor from Truthout, written by Erica West, the socialist worker. Let's begin. We are constantly confronted by the problems of modern society. Homelessness, violence, underfunded schools, environmental pollution, the list goes on. Many people who want to address these urgent issues figure that working at a nonprofit or non-governmental organization, also known as NGOs, is a great way to make a difference and get paid for doing it. Now, full disclosure, I currently work for nonprofits right now. Actually, I don't know if Horizon Home Care is a nonprofit, but it's a distributor, is a middleman for Medicaid payments for aid services. So, but my current job trajectory right now is that I want to keep working for nonprofits, kind of as a lesser evil kind of thing, you know, as opposed to working for a big corporation or for some business owner. At least in a nonprofit, you don't do well there unless you care. So the managers there care, the board members care. I'd rather work for an enterprise based on caring, regardless or not, that it fits into the capitalist system. Buttressing it. Okay. And it seems like the number of jobs available in nonprofits keeps growing. As politicians hack away at government programs, social service agencies, and other safety net programs that provide these crucial supports for poor working class people, service nonprofits often fill the gaps. While nonprofit, putting scare quotes, can refer to any institution with a business status, the phrase service nonprofit is more specific, referring to nonprofits that engage directly in providing services to people, such as beds for homeless people, or advocating for services like Planned Parenthood's Action Fund. Service nonprofits are part of what some progressives and leftists sometimes refer to as the nonprofit industrial complex. The U.S. nonprofit sector today accounts for more than $1 trillion in annual economic activity, making it on its own one of the world's largest economies. The anthology, The Revolution Will Not Be Funded, defines the nonprofit industrial complex as, using academic jargon here, a set of symbiotic relationships that link political and financial technologies of the state, meaning state apparatus, and the owning class control, meaning capitalists, with surveillance over public political ideology, including and especially emergent progressive and leftist social movements. Let's go into what that means. So what are the limits of nonprofits in the fight against injustice in the here and now and against capitalism in the long term? For folks who have worked in nonprofits, one of the most obvious problems is the professionalization of nonprofit work, including the growing number of people seeking advanced degrees in nonprofit management, which seeks to bring corporate management techniques to the world of nonprofits. Nonprofits may be required, so that is saying that making these nonprofit-seeking enterprises more like corporate businesses. Nonprofits may be required to have employees with a certain advanced degree in order to bill for services and receive fundings from programs. And this goes for the grants themselves that fund such enterprises. Such as Medi-Cal in California or the Federal Medicaid Healthcare Program. Foundations themselves may place whatever stipulations they want in grants, including requiring those who provide services to have advanced degrees, such as a PhD in psychology, even if it's not necessarily needed. The professionalization creates stratification, meaning different levels, between nonprofit employees and the clients they serve, creates a barrier of education and other things, as well as among those with and without such degrees within the nonprofit. One consequence of this dynamic is that the people who are clients of service nonprofits are practically locked out of the jobs at these organizations. Under the idea not expressed, explained in full here, that people need to have a say in the services that are rendered to them, right? The customer is always right. Well, shouldn't the client always be always right? Right, and that means, and the best healthcare workers, or the best service workers, are those that have received said service. They should be involved, and that means they should be some of these workers as well. Especially once the services help them, say, get out of the pit of poverty, the pit of mental illness. They should be able to then help other people. Oh, but first they need a 5, 6, 8 year education. But then you have to go into massive debt, and then boom, you're back in the poverty hole. Or then you're stuck working for paltry wages and da-da-da-da-da. Now this is a shame because the people who experience the problems are the ones who should be crafting the solutions. Now nonprofits themselves, like capitalist businesses, corporations, they have ideology. They have ideas that are foundational to how they work. Service nonprofits and the related nonprofits and institutions that support them also have an ideological purpose. Don Last writes about the relevance of the idea of the Italian revolutionary Gramsci to the child welfare system in his book, When the Welfare People Come. His analysis applies to service nonprofits as well. One of Gramsci's insights was to explain how capitalist society is able to maintain its legitimacy despite the yawning chasm between those with immense wealth and those who suffer deep poverty. Key to his argument are the concepts of civil society and political society. This is Gramsci's work. So by political society, Gramsci meant those state institutions that rule through force, such as prisons, the courts, and the police. By civil society, he is referring to the aspects of the state, the government, that rule through consent, which differs from the way many today use that term, voluntary association. Civil society is usually men, and it means usually to me any voluntary association. So sometimes my definition of anarchism is government by civil society. But that, if you use Gramsci's terms, that wouldn't make any sense. It wouldn't be any different. Because we are ruled by this type of civil society. So political society stands ready to enforce decisions when civil society cannot obtain consent. When employees of service nonprofits are mandated reporters, for example, when they are required to make a report to Child Protective Services when child abuse and neglect is suspected, they are enlisted as agents of the coercive function of the state. Some professionals are mandated reporters through the licensing process, but others, such as administrative assistants, may be required to be mandated reporters because a grant says so. Lash goes into great detail as to why child welfare system is oppressive, deeply racist, and not capable of productively transforming the lives of the families under its control. Control being an operative word. Thus, the label of a mandated reporter can turn an entire profession or an entire workplace into a place to surveil and punish the poor, which is almost exclusively Black and Latino. Talking about cities, though. Obviously, this also occurs in rural areas where it is exclusively white families or poor white families. This coercive state is also manifested when nonprofit employees are forced to call the police. For example, a drug rehab facility may permit only adults without children to access its services. Perhaps their grant requires this, and so there is little that workers on the ground can do. If a man staying there brings his daughter, he may be asked to leave, in effect making the family homeless. If he refuses, the cops might be called. These specific examples offer some worst-case scenarios, but even when nonprofits are not directly extending the coercive role of the state, they play a supporting role through their civil functions. So the phrase civil society may conjure up any number of images. Governmental bodies, schools, and other civil institutions. Civil being quotes. In Lash's book, he describes the civil society as the network of organizations used to elaborate and disseminate ideology. Right, and that includes the media. Gramsci's extended theory of the state holds that civil society maintains domination, a hegemony of dominant ideas, meaning allowable ideas. Nonprofits, though, through the services they provide and the media and other campaigns they design, explicitly and implicitly reinforce and perpetuate certain ideas. For example, in their work, they frame what is the appropriate solution to social problems. The existence of homeless shelters and the various networks that interact with and depend on these shelters reinforce the idea that shelters are the appropriate solution to homelessness, as opposed to, say, homeless people organizing themselves or transforming the economic system that produces far more empty homes than there are homeless people to fill them. A different example is Planned Parenthood's Action Fund, which reinforces and perpetuates the idea that the solution to large-scale political problems is donating to an organization that then hires a lobbyist, as opposed to, say, building a mass movement capable of occupying Congress, or otherwise disrupting business as usual until its demands are met. So you'll have in the activist communities across the nation a tension between those that want to build mass movements, want to take direct action, want to apply pressure, disrupt business as usual, be disruptors, do some creative destruction, and civil society groups, political action committees and whatnot, who simply want to act as lobbying arms for their constituents, their donors, whether they be grassroots donors or a few large donors that then support them, giving them a base to then have more appropriate constituents like actual working class people. By framing the solutions to problems in a particular way, nonprofits also implicitly frame where these problems come from in the first place. When the solution to homelessness is individualized, beds for each person, often given on a day-to-day basis, or even, getting each individual person their own home, the logical conclusion is that the cause of the problem is also individual. This ideology is necessary to justify the use of coercion and force if and when it is used. And because there is a hegemonic idea, a dominant idea, about the cause of these problems, namely individual bad luck or irresponsibility, it makes a collective solution seem irrational. I'm a crazy commie, guys. Finally, nonprofits also reinforce an ideology about the most appropriate way about change, namely working for a nonprofit. And who benefits when goodwill people committed to social justice? This ideology about what is acceptable and what is not, about where social problems come from and where they don't, is taught to nonprofit workers in their workplaces, to professionals in their training programs, and as they prepare to enter this job market, and to the larger society as witnesses to all of this. And often the organizations perpetuating these ideas, writing the curricula of schools and hosting trainings, are themselves nonprofits. This helps to illustrate what is meant by the phrase nonprofit industrial complex, the web of nonprofits that interacts at different points to avert the worst social catastrophes, you know, come with people dying in the streets, perpetuates the ideology that explains poverty and hardship as a matter of individual responsibility, and when need be, justifies coercive and violent elements of the state. You know, calling the cops as a last resort. But it says, nonprofit workers need to see themselves as workers. We could, instead of nonprofits, they could be co-ops providing these services. Every worker has the power to withhold their labor, and when coordinated with co-workers, collective withholding of labor halts any work. If you work at a nonprofit, you may be a therapist or a fundraiser or administrative assistant. We are also workers. Nonprofit workers will have experiences similar to most other workers. They get paid little when the boss gets paid way too much. Now, this is describing certain nonprofits, not the one I'm working for right now. So at Whitaker Street Health Center in Boston, workers were seeking to unionize in order to address chronic understaffing and underpayment of wages. Because it's one thing to talk about these abuses of the nonprofit industry and so on, but let's actually talk about like what is this really talking about here. So in certain nonprofits, okay, they're well-funded, but let's say the director is paid five times more, you know, a very good salary, while the people doing the actual social work are not. So workers were seeking to unionize in order to address chronic understaffing and underpayment of wages. In response, management hired a law firm whose website boasted of having helped dozens of employers successfully defeat union organizing drives. Just because they say they care doesn't mean they're actually for for solidarity of people. Just 6 days before the June 20th vote to unionize, the clinic went on the offensive, firing 20 workers. Coincidentally, many of those who were fired were publicly in support of the union. The next day, workers protested outside the clinic, and the day after that, the workers had their jobs back. All of this happened before the union vote, and once the vote took place, workers voted overwhelmingly to join SEIU, United Healthcare Workers East. That's 1199, which operates in my area as well. It's the union that many nurses, actually no, they're forming their own association. They have. At Planned Parenthood of the Rocky Mountains in Colorado, employees won their vote to unionize in fall of 2017. Executives at PPRM turned the Trump administration, however, rather the National Labor Relations Board under the Trump administration, arguing that the union effort, quote, ought to include all the clinics in the regional agency, which spans three states. They argue that they are, quote, not currently opposing efforts to organize our affiliate, but we have asked the National Labor Relations Board, tool of the state that it is, to consider whether all of our employees should be able to participate. Sounds like a reasonable thing, you know, more workers should be able to organize, right? Ah, but this is forcing the workers to organize across three states is a surefire way to tank their efforts. And turning to Trump's Labor Relations Board risks setting a bad precedent for nonprofits. So why do it? Because under capitalism, there is a fundamental tension between bosses and workers. Workers want their rights respected. Bosses want to reduce workers' struggles in order to keep costs at a minimum. By what workers' struggles, they mean organizing. This is true in factories when workers are making car parts, and it's true of Planned Parenthood when workers are providing health care. Unionizing is important for nonprofit workers for a few reasons. Unions are formal organizations that give workers a way to resist the boss's efforts to drive down their wages and working conditions. Now, this is usually talking about very large nonprofits. Some hospitals that break in millions of dollars are also classified as being nonprofits. Thus, they're tax exempt, even though they are very, very large institutions that gobble up property, increase gentrification, certain hospitals. Just look at Cleveland. No union is perfect, though, but unions give workers a voice in how their workplaces are run. So, you know, normal pro-union writing here. Now for some writing on nonprofits and anti-capitalist strategy. Well, as leftists, we are anti-capitalists. If you're not anti-capitalist, you need to make the case why you consider yourself the left. Let's see. Not all nonprofits fit the image of this horrible union-busting organization, though. There are many nonprofits that participate in movement activism and that socialists may find many points of agreement with. Example. In September 2017, staff with the California Immigrant Youth Justice Alliance interrupted a press conference by House Minority Leader Pelosi to demand a clean DREAM Act. The DREAM Act would provide a pathway to citizenship for 2 million immigrant youth and young adults who came to the U.S. as children. And a clean DREAM Act would do this without other measures harmful to immigrant communities, such as funding for border walls, border enforcement, or detention centers, so on. After this protest, this nonprofit statewide coordinator wrote an op-ed in the Huffington Post denouncing Obama as a deporter-in-chief, September 2017. Interrupting politicians, demanding amnesty for all immigrants, and highlighting the complicity of both parties in terrorizing immigrant communities, these are strategies that any social justice activist would agree with. This nonprofit, the youth, does admirable work. The point is not all nonprofits do bad things, but they do all share certain limitations, okay? Nonprofits address the symptoms of a broken system. Racist, anti-immigrant policies, lack of access to healthcare, housing, or emotional support, but they do not have a strategy for addressing the underlying disease, namely capitalism. Now, I want to stress, personally and with this program, nothing is to be taken as an absolute. I'm anti-dogma. And I think if anything holds the left back in our progress, it's dogmatism. People taking a very absolute line about things. So what would that look like? I'm criticizing nonprofits. If you were to take an absolute dogmatic take on that or a conclusion, it would be then you should never work for a nonprofit. Nonprofits are bad. They're just as bad as Walmart and Bezos and Amazon, you know, this call for unionization of nonprofit workers. I should not, you know, just throw it all out. But as this section here points out, and as I would, I want to stress the conclusion, is that criticism does not negate the enjoyment, the approval, the support of anything. Whether it be media criticism, doesn't mean throw out all the media. You know, never see this movie. Don't even think about enjoying it. No, that is the straw man created by reactionaries of various types. And there is a type of reactionary leftist that takes this absolutist line. Usually follows from having a black and white morality. It's harder to see grays. Taken from The Revolution Will Not Be Funded, Paul Kiven writes, when temporary shelter becomes a substitute for permanent housing, emergency food a substitute for a decent job, tutoring a substitute for adequate public schools, and free clinics a substitute for universal health care, we have shifted our attention from the redistribution of wealth and production to a temporary provision of social services to keep people alive. Is that all we can hope for? Keeping people alive? As socialists, says the writer, we know that society has enough wealth and sufficient technical means to do much more than simply keep people alive. We are fighting for a world where people's basic needs are not only met, but for a world where we can all thrive. Working at a nonprofit doesn't mean advancing the struggle for such a world, which would require getting rid of the profit motive as the key mechanism for determining where production goes. The best nonprofits seek to bring improvements in people's lives, but our aim is to fight for a social society that puts people before profits, that puts the working class in control of factories and offices, in control of the products of their own labor, aka changing the mode of production. And if nonprofits don't have this as their aim, it's important to ask what method of organization will bring the change we want to see. If, as Marx wrote, the emancipation of the working class, freedom, must be the act of workers themselves, then a professional class of nonprofit workers advocating for liberation on behalf of other people won't be enough. And that includes myself, because as far as my college degree and the way I was raised and the current way I tackle my work situation, earning a living, making wages, I'm a professional class nonprofit worker. And it has a name, the professional managerial class. I don't know if it's mentioned in the other, but I don't have enough time for it. But this is called the professional managerial class. And thinking of classes, it's important that there isn't just the owning class and there's the working class, which is usually the framing, make it binary, make it simple. But there's also middle class. And class is not a matter of income. It's a way of judging it, perhaps. But more important is in classes, in thinking about class, is their function in society. And the professional class has a function, right? They manage the lives of the poor half the time, whether it be in social services, whether it be in public sector. But there's also lots of private sector enterprises that manage the poor. They manage finances. They manage communities. Banks do this to some extent with who they loan to. It's critical that all workers and oppressed people participate in their own liberation. This is through movements, unions, to coalesce, to join things, even reading groups, and they organize themselves to fight in their own interests, even if it's picking up litter. Although picking up litter will kind of remind you how you're just kind of tackling the surface issue, which is litter, what you can see, but the litter will be back because our food system is based around mass consumption and wrapping things up, and it's not farm to table. It's not from farmers. Farmers don't have to wrap up their food because you're not shipping it for 1,000 miles. If we want less litter, we need a food system that isn't shipping things from far away. That means limiting our diet to what can be grown around, although there's certainly a lot of technical means to grow whatever you want. I think I want to end the show, actually. I have two more things. One is about a political action against the Florida Department of Transportation. They use prisoners, because Florida has a lot of prisons, federal, state, local prisons, and they're using these prisoners for road work, right? So rather than paying workers or people who are not in jail good wages, they're using prison labor, also known as slavery. So that was being called out by an action, and they blocked and disrupted the offices of the Department of Transportation there. So that overlaps with that, men in prison allows women to be evicted more. And it overlaps with then freaking slavery existing. Since it's mostly black men. There's connotations of that, I think. The other story is the CEO of a school district. So it is about school lunches and how something that should be free and provided as a right isn't, because there's money to be made, apparently, or budgets to be filled. Because school districts themselves, and this is in Wyoming, and basically a story of a guy wants to pay off the school debt, this school lunch debt the students shouldn't even have. But the CEO is making it, a crusade of personal responsibility. The parents that don't want to pay for their kids' lunches need to be held for account. And thus, another example of a professional, a guy in charge, white guy in charge, facing off against another white guy who wants to do a debt jubilee, help out these poor families. Just, you know, just a one-time thing, maybe not. But he grew up poor, so he understands that if it's choosing between, you know, it's kids getting meals at school is a big boost. When in fact, you know, if most of your income is going to rent, as has been explained, that guy only had $2 a day. Can't even buy rice with that. Yeah, so those are two stories that are kind of on the ground stuff to kind of hammer in general points I've been making. So I don't think I need to summarize any more. I'll just go into the housekeeping. I want to thank you all for listening. Listening is an important skill and as important as talking, so I plan to listen to any constructive feedback you send in, ideas for the show, or stories or topics you'd like to hear discussed. Or if you'd like me to elaborate or do my homework on anything I've said during this program. The important thing is to put these ideas and projects that we talk about here into practice for yourself. In this case, it was more about just thinking in terms of class, thinking like a Marxist. I myself am multi-tenancy. That means, you know, they call this the three left show because there are multiple types of ways of being left, and I consider myself a little bit of all of them. Being centered on ecology, I'm being a socialist. Am I just state focused? No. Am I just focused on direct action, you know, in an anarchist mode of organizing just with your pals and ignoring all of these other institutions? You can't really do it all at once, but I'm in support of all of it. And that's what solidarity means. Starting now in Albany is a solidarity action for Rojava. Those are the left-wing Kurds that our empire is basically leaving high and dry for the Turkish state to evade. And it's basically a matter of states being states suck. And regardless of what the solution is, whether it's dissolving all nation states, which is probably the real solution, whether it's we need to get U.S. troops back in Syria, or we need to, and this is a simple thing, if we really want to talk about pulling out of the Middle East, then we need to pull out all of our material and military support from Turkey, from Saudi Arabia, and thus the resources for ISIS will dry up. Because that is, ISIS is propped up and supported by Turkey and Saudi Arabia, if you didn't know. That's why keeping the pressure on Turkey is so necessary. But we can do that by simply withdrawing our military support from them, because the weapons they're using against the Kurds, they're made in America, folks. We gave it to them. Just like with Saddam, just like with everybody. We make the weapons, we give them to everyone, and then, oh no, there's war and chaos and bad things. But money-making occurred. Many people, many white men, fucking made rich by doing this. So with that, I'm going to end the show. I mentioned the other things, don't I? I am on social media. There's Facebook, there's Twitter, Three Left Show. I have a website where all episodes of this podcast are covered, are archived. There's Three Lefts, that's numeral3lefts.news and nothing else. I have now got the podcast on Spotify. It is on Spotify now. So I don't know if there's any other podcast apps the podcast cannot be found, but I think I can confidently say the podcast can be found on all major podcasting apps. And a lot of minor ones as well. I've checked. I have a Patreon account. Go to the Three Left Show on Patreon to materially support, because things don't transform unless something real is involved. That means having the resources to pay for advertising, another form of kind of rent for cultural access, to suck my bank out of my bank account, and other kinds of outreach that I want to do. Which I currently have to self-fund, which is a bit limited since I really, really thank you and enjoy your company. So I'm your host, Dan Platt. This has been the Three Left Show. Stay frosty, everybody.